The passage for the sermon today will be found in Luke chapter 20, verse 18 verses. One day, as Jesus was teaching the people in the temple and preaching the gospel, the chief priests and the scribes with the elders came up and said to him, "Tell us by what authority you do these things, or who is it that gave you this authority?" He answered them, "I also will ask you a question. Now tell me, was the baptism of John from heaven or from man?" And he discussed it with one another, saying, "If we say, 'From heaven,' he will say, 'Why did you not believe him?' But if we say, 'From man,' all the people will stone us to death, for they are convinced that John was a prophet." So they answered that they did not know where it came from. And Jesus said to them, "Neither will I tell you by what authority I do these things." And he began to tell the people this parable. A man planted a vineyard and let it out to tenants who went into another country for a long while. When the time came, he sent a servant to the tenants so that they would give him some of the fruit of the vineyard. But the tenants beat him and sent him away empty-handed. And he sent another servant, but they also beat him and treated him shamefully and sent him away empty-handed. And he sent yet a third. This one also they wounded and cast out. Then the owner of the vineyard said, "What shall I do? I will send my beloved son. Perhaps they will respect him." But when the tenants saw him, they said to themselves, "This is the heir. Let us kill him so that the inheritance may be ours." And they threw him out of the vineyard and killed him. What then will the owner of the vineyard do to them? He will come and destroy those tenants and give the vineyard to others. When they heard this, they said, "Surely not." But he looked directly at them and said, "What then is this that is written? The stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. Everyone who falls on that stone will be broken to pieces, and when it falls on anyone, it will crush him."
Well, I suppose that right off the bat, I should maybe say something about the title of this sermon as an attempt to get ahead of the angry emails. The title is not a reference to the foolish decision that my home and native land made this past week to legalize marijuana. It is rather a reference to a well-known Bob Dylan song. And the song was controversial when it came out because the recurring line in it, "Everybody must get stoned," seemed like it was an explicit call for young people to get high. But in actual fact, this was not a drug song. Bob Dylan claims that he never wrote a drug song. Instead, this song is about opposition and conflict. This is about the biblical kind of stoning that you might receive when you're in opposition to someone. And that's the sense that I want to take it this morning. Everybody must get stoned. I think it's a fitting soundtrack for our passage today because as we come into chapter 20 of Luke's gospel, we're beginning a whole new phase in Jesus' ministry. This is the last week before he goes to the cross and gives himself as a sacrifice for sin. And it's in this week especially where he encounters the heaviest opposition. Of course, he's encountered conflict and opposition all along, but it really comes to a climax here in this last week. And so what we're going to find in the next couple of chapters of Luke's gospel is lots of different encounters between Jesus and the Pharisees and the scribes, the Jewish religious leaders that were out to get Jesus. For a while, those guys have just kind of been on the sidelines, lurking, waiting, just, you know, collecting information. But now, as we saw now a couple weeks ago when we left off, we saw that if you look at verse 47 of chapter 19, the chief priests and the scribes and the principal men of the people were seeking to destroy him. So now their animosity towards Jesus had got to the point where they want to kill him. They want to be done with him. This is very heavy, intense times. And so all of the conflict, all of the entrapment is going to get ratcheted all the way up to the highest level. And Jesus, of course, is well aware of all of these schemes. None of this is any kind of surprise to him. He's undeterred by him. And during this last week of public ministry, Jesus is going to be more explicit than he's ever been about things like the temple and the Jewish religious system and all of it. Jesus is not going to be deterred. He's not going to be shamed or silenced. This is a pretty intense week that we're coming into. And what I am suggesting is that the stones are going to start flying from every direction in these next couple of chapters. We're going to find that in this setting, at this time, everybody must get stoned. So this morning, as we work our way through the first 18 verses, I want to take a closer look at a number of these stonings, so to speak. Okay, so I've got a few pointed out for you from our passage this morning. Number one, they'll stone you when you are gospelizing. They'll stone you when you are gospelizing. Now, when we come into verse 1 here, we find Jesus doing what he is always doing. I love this about Jesus. Nothing gets him off of his main purpose and his mission, and that is that he is teaching the people in the temple, and he is preaching the gospel to them. This is why he's come, to preach the good news to the poor, to proclaim salvation and the need for repentance in the light of the fact that the kingdom of God is here. Everywhere Jesus goes, people are gathering around him, and he is sure to be teaching and preaching that one important message. Now, even though the previous passage makes clear that the people by and large have rejected him, the Israelites and the Jewish leaders, and even though, as we saw, the temple is doomed for destruction, it's really interesting to me that Jesus doesn't abandon it, right? Jesus doesn't take he doesn't say what we might be tempted to say, which is, oh man, all of this is going to hell in a handbasket. These people are damned. This temple is doomed. I should just pull on out of here. No, Jesus' position seems to be, this people and this place are going to hell in a handbasket. So while there's still time, while I'm still here, I'm going to preach the good news to them. I'm going to preach the gospel of the kingdom of God to anyone who will listen. And I believe that that ought to be our example, too, as we go out into a world that, by all appearances, by any account, is increasingly hostile to the things of the Lord. And we look outside, we look and see all the craziness, all of the violence, and we think, oh, this world is done. They're going to hell in a handbasket. What we ought not to do is withdraw. Instead, what we ought to do is press in even harder with the good news of the gospel every day while there's still time. This is what Jesus did, and this is what he calls us to do. The gospel is the only hope for a lost and dying world. And so we would be unfaithful. We would be poor servants if we were to not hold forth that good news while it is still called today. Jesus, again, perfect example for us in this, our great commission. So Jesus is preaching and teaching the good news, but as we said, they'll stone you when you are gospelizing. And sure enough, here come the bigwigs, the chief priests, the scribes, the elders of the people, you know, the really important people. And these three groups that Luke mentions are actually the three groups that make up the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin is like the circuit court of the Jewish religion. So they would hear all kinds of matters of religious questions or disputes. They were like the supreme court of religion in that time. So it looks like this is an official group of religious leaders, and they've come to question Jesus. And the thing that they're most interested in is the issue of authority. They demand to know, as verse 2 tells us, by what authority, or to put it another way, under whose authority Are you, Jesus, doing these things? Now, when they say these things, certainly they have in mind what Jesus has just finished doing, which is to overturn the tables in the temple, you know, to make a whip and drive people out of the temple who are profaning it by their selling, by all of their evil. So I'm sure they have that in mind when they say these things. But it must also be the fact that he is in the temple precincts and he is sitting down, taking the posture of a rabbi, and people are gathering all around him. That is an authoritative kind of thing to do. It's something that these chief priests and scribes and elders would typically do. And so they want to know from Jesus, who told you you could do this? Who gave you the right to do all of these things? The implication is that it was certainly not by their authority that Jesus was doing these things. And that's a problem, because if anything was to get done, if anything was supposed to be going on in that whole religious setting, it would be through them. They were the authority in that time, at that place, and they had no interaction with Jesus. So, Jesus, where are you getting this authority? Tell us. We demand to know. And it's interesting to me that actually the scribes and the Pharisees and the elders, they've stumbled on the crucial issue as it pertains to Jesus, and as it pertains to you, by the way, and me, for that matter. It's the issue of authority. Now, for us Americans, that word authority is a bad word. It's a dirty word, almost, because we have a very anti-authoritarian streak. In fact, Bob Dylan is kind of the poster boy for this spirit. Dylan rose to fame in the 60s and in the 70s by, like, sticking it to the man and, you know, standing up to senators and congressmen and mothers and fathers. They were all put on notice that your sons and your daughters are beyond your command, as he would sing, because the times, they are a-changing. We don't like authority. But here's the thing. It's not that we're opposed to authority as Americans, as human beings. We actually like authority. We want it for ourselves. The problem with authority is we have a problem with outside authority. We want to be our own authority. We don't like having any kind of authority external to us or over us by which we are made to submit. That's our problem. And it's a crucial issue to know the authority for what it is that we do. And ultimately, there's only two sources of authority. It all boils down to two sources, two possibilities. You're either doing things under the authority of God, or you're doing things by the authority of man. So the authority can either come from heaven, or it can be earthbound authority that gives you your marching orders. So it's very, very insightful, actually, that the Pharisees would raise the authority question. Because think about it. If Jesus is a mere man operating with an earthly mandate, just by an earthly kind of authority, then you can totally disregard him. He's just another nut job in the temple. But if he is sent from God, that's a different thing entirely. If that's true, if he's coming with heavenly authority, then you would disregard him and reject him to your peril. This isn't just a question that the scribes and the Pharisees ought to be asking, by the way. This is a question that every single person needs to ask and answer about Jesus. By what authority has Jesus come? This Christian religion that we subscribe to, this gospel that we preach, this salvation that's offered, it's either the product of the imagination and the invention of man, or it is authored and authorized by God. Those are really the only two options. There's no other choice. And you're going to have to make a decision about Jesus and about his authority. If what it is that we're preaching is the invention of man, well then you should leave. I mean, we should just go home. There's still time to go home and get some snacks together ready for the football game. But if this gospel is from God, then you need to embrace it. You need to submit yourself to it. So I would urge you for yourself to ask and answer that authority question when it comes to Jesus. It's just that in this case, in the case of the Pharisees, it's way too late to be asking this question. Here we are in chapter 20. Jesus has been in public ministry for 3 years, right? You can't be raising the authority question now. That ship has sailed. It's like when there's a new person in church, say. Okay, there's a visitor that comes to church and you go and talk, you introduce yourself to them, and then they keep coming back week after week, and every week you seek them out and you have a nice conversation. But the problem is you don't remember their name. They told you that first Sunday, and basically just as soon as they told you, it was gone. It was almost like you weren't even listening. Anyway, you don't know their name, and now 4 or 6 weeks has gone by, and what's the problem? Problem is, you can't even ask now. I mean, that ship has sailed. The window of opportunity has slammed weeks ago. The best you can do is just kind of hope that you overhear them introducing themselves to other people or get someone else to ask them the first time. But the same thing's going on here, it seems to me, that this is a bizarre question to be asking Jesus after 3 years. Yeah, the opportunity, I think, has passed for this to be a genuine kind of questions. So I'm sorry, chief priests and scribes and elders, but you can't seriously be asking the authority question in chapter 20 during the last week of Jesus' public ministry. That ship has sailed. The question has been asked and answered multiple times in multiple different ways in the Gospel of Luke. For example, Jesus' birth was announced by angels, individual angels, and then a host of angels announced the birth of Jesus. He was preceded by John the Baptist, who was called to prepare the way of the Lord. At his baptism, a voice boomed from heaven which says, "This is my beloved Son." And then again on the Mount of Transfiguration, a voice from the cloud said, "This is my beloved Son, listen to him." As he taught, people were astonished at his teaching, and they would exclaim, "This guy is teaching not like the scribes and the Pharisees. This guy is teaching with authority." Jesus cast out lots of demons. And every time these demons shrieked and they cried out, "We know who you are. You are the Son of the Most High. You are the Holy One of God." Jesus healed the sick. He fed the hungry. He opened the eyes of the blind. And it was perfectly obvious to everybody that no one could do these things unless they were sent by God. So just over and over, from multiple witnesses, demons, angels, multitudes of people, the miracles, the works themselves, everything is shouting, "This is the Son of God," and he comes with divine authority. And then chapter 20, the chief priests and scribes and elders come along and say, "What authority are you doing this under again?" It's hardly a genuine question at this point. I suspect they're asking it because they're really feeling the pinch that the authority that these religious leaders believe that they have is now threatened. as they look out at the people are crowded around Jesus. They're not crowding around them. And so what they want to do is discredit Jesus. They want to they want to just remove all of his credibility in the eyes of the people. They want to squelch his teaching. Yeah, they'll stone you when you are gospelizing. That's the first thing that we see. And secondly, they'll stone you when the prophets you're denying. They'll stone you when the prophets you're denying. This brings us to verse number 3. I love this exchange. It's really interesting to me how Jesus responds to the Sanhedrin's question. He basically says, "No, let me ask you a question. The baptism of John, was it from heaven or from man?" That's a great question to ask. That's a perfect question for Jesus to ask because, again, it gets right to the real issue, which is authority. And furthermore, because Jesus and John are related, not just in terms of their DNA, but in terms of their mission, John comes as a prelude to Jesus, then sort of their ministries were kind of a pair. And so if you answered the authority question for the one, then it would necessarily answer it for the other one as well. Furthermore, the scribes and the Pharisees and the elders of the people must have come to some sort of a conclusion about who John the Baptist was. I mean, that was a pretty obvious person to arrive on the scene, and it was a whole weird thing. They must have come to some conclusion about who John the Baptist was and the authority that the authenticity of his ministry. So this should be a no-brainer for them. And it's also a great question because it also only permits two possible answers. It's either from God or it's from man. You have to pick one when it comes to authority. Where did John get his authority? From heaven or from earth? So here's what we see in verse 5. We see the scribes and the Pharisees and the elders. They're all huddled together like a family who has a chance to steal on Family Feud. You know, they're in that circle, and they've got to come up with one answer. They've got to come up with the best answer. And Luke, I love this, he enables us to listen in on their deliberations. We get to hear them talk through the possibilities and the implications. And it's at the very same time humorous and painful to watch these religious leaders impale themselves on the horns of a dilemma. Here's the dilemma, verse 5. They're saying to themselves, if we say from heaven, if we say that John has a legitimate God-ordained authority for his ministry, for his baptism, then Jesus is going to just ask us, well, then why didn't you believe it? Why didn't you obey if you knew it was from God? So that's a problem. We can't really go down that route. You know, that's not going to be a good look for us to have it exposed that we believed that something was of God, but we wanted nothing to do with it, and we didn't obey. We didn't submit to that baptism. So we can't have that. But the other option is just as problematic. If we say that his ministry was from man, that the authority that John had was just an earthly kind of a thing, then that's not going to fly either. You know, people believe that John the Baptist was a true prophet. And if we say that he was a crazy man operating on his own authority, then we're going to get in trouble with all of these people. All of these people who have concluded the opposite way. The problem is they'll stone you if the prophets you're denying. Because that actually is the Old Testament punishment for declaring a true prophet to be a false prophet. He had authorization. People had authorization to stone someone who who said that a true prophet of God was actually a false prophet. So that's not going to fly either. They're afraid that these people are going to stone them. And so now there's the deliberation, and now we've got, you know, Steve Harvey trying to hurry them up, saying to the family, time's up, come on, what's it going to be? Give us your final answer. And what is their final answer? Well, the answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. They answered, here's what the text says, that they did not know where the baptism of John came from. We don't know. That's their answer. They plead agnostic to the question. But we've already heard their deliberations. We've already eavesdropped there, and we know that that's not an honest, I don't know. We know it's a cop-out. We know it's cowardice. We know it's not a we don't know. It's a we won't know. Unbelief, you have to understand, is not an intellectual problem that people have. It's a moral problem. The issue is not an inability to know God and to believe in God and upon Jesus Christ. The real problem that people have is a blatant, willful unwillingness to believe what they know deep down to be true. So they say, we don't know. But that puts that's not satisfactory either. That puts these religious leaders in a very pathetic position. Here they are. They're supposed to be the wisest, most spiritually discerning people around, and they can't even tell you if John the Baptist is a true or false prophet. I mean, that's Sanhedrin 101. You should be able to do that. And they can't, or rather, they won't. So consider what we've learned about the issue of authority just from this little exchange. We've learned that Jesus has the authority. Even though he hasn't answered their question, he hasn't answered their question about where he gets his authority from, but he has certainly demonstrated that he is the one with the authority of God. Did you see how quickly he turned the tables on these people? This is actually the second time he's turned the tables in the temple. But they come to him, all important. They're the official delegation. They're trying to intimidate him. And just with a word, just with a sentence, he turns it so that it's a real power move. And rightly so, because Jesus is the authority. And he puts them in their place. He says, no, I'm going to ask you a question. Now you guys tell me. This demonstrates the absolute authority of Jesus. He has complete mastery over the whole situation, over the whole conversation. And then consider the authority of the Pharisees and the scribes and the elders. They would want you to believe that they are living and ministering under the authority of God. They are God's appointed men for the task of being the religious leader of the people. They would definitely say that they have a divine authority for what they do. But what have we discovered just from this little exchange? We've discovered from verse 6 that these guys respond to things based on how it will be received by the people. So they're controlled by a fear of man, which means at the end of the day that all that they have is a mere earthly authority. They're just operating out of this fear of man on the earthbound plane. They have no mind whatsoever for God and for his way and for his truth. These people are not God's agents. These are strangers to God's ways. More than this, they're his enemies. And Jesus makes that point abundantly clear in the parable that he now tells all of the people that he's teaching. Beginning in verse 9, and from this parable comes our third observation, which is, they'll stone you if you're God's beloved son. we're almost at the point in our contemporary Christian culture, or American culture, I should say, where it is impossible to distinguish between parody and reality. Things are so wacky nowadays that when you flip on the TV, you can't immediately tell if you're watching the 11 o'clock news or the weekend update on Saturday Night Live. Okay, you have to really think about it for a second, because the reality is satire almost. You can't exaggerate something to make it stand out, because it's already exaggerated. And the same thing, I think, is happening in this parable that Jesus tells. You know, a parable is meant to be a sort of allegory where characters and events are embellished so that it will highlight a certain truth. But this particular parable really blurs the line between allegory and reality. Like, the stuff that Jesus is going to describe, he's going to tell you a story, typical parable form, but it is so close to the actual reality of things that it's scary. What Jesus does here, for the sake of the people and for the Sanhedrin that's listening, is he gives basically a story that will describe Israel's past and their present situation. And the story is fairly straightforward. It's easy for us to understand. It says a man planted a vineyard and let it out to tenants and went into another country for a long while. This is very similar to other parables that Jesus has told that we've looked at. So we know that a businessman, a venture capitalist, would want to buy a vineyard and plant a vineyard so as to grow grapes that could be turned into wine. He could make lots of money on these wine tourist types of things. But this is a businessman who's got his hand in lots of other things, right? So the ideal setup is that he's gonna rent out that vineyard to tenants, and then he's gonna go somewhere else and he's gonna establish some other business. And the arrangement is gonna be that these tenants are going to tend to the vines. They're gonna do all of the work. They're going to reap the harvest, and as payment for them to be able to do that and to earn a living off of it, the master is simply just asking for a portion of the harvest. He wants, you know, like however many barrels of wine that come out of the vineyard. It's a very standard arrangement for that time and that place. So far, so good. So when the time comes, maybe after a couple of years of that vineyard growing up and beginning to produce, verse 10, when the time came, he sent a servant to the tenants so that they would give him some of the fruit of the vineyard. That's what he's owed. But the tenants beat him and sent him away empty-handed. Now that's crazy. All of a sudden the story just got crazy. That's unheard of. That tenants would do that to the servant of the person that they're in this business arrangement of. But the verse 11, the boss there sends another servant to collect what's rightfully his share of the fruit. But they also beat and treat him shamefully, and they sent him away empty-handed. Crazy. And then he sent a third. It just keeps going on. That's an embellishment that's just would blow people's minds. It should be surprising to you too. You're thinking, who is this master? And you're starting to feel a little bit sorry for the servants. You picture the situation where they're getting their orders for that day, and all of them, like by the time he's getting ready to send the third one, all of them are like not making eye contact with him. And they sent a third, verse 12. This one also they wounded and cast out. And now you have a little insight into the owner's deliberation. He says in verse 13, "What should I do now? I've sent three servants. They've all got come back to me beaten with nothing. What do I do now? I know. I've got an idea. I will send my beloved son. Perhaps they'll respect him." This, again, we're really blending the line. Jesus is really blending the line here between allegory and reality, because this is precisely what God has done. This vineyard represents Israel, the people of God, the people that God has chosen for his possession, that he would be their God and that they would be his people. And the picture of a vineyard representing the country, that was something that is pervasive throughout the Old Testament. And it's a symbol of fruitfulness. God's idea, God's determination was that Israel would be blessed of him so that they could be a blessing to the nations. And he looks to Israel and he looks for this fruit, for this blessing. And he doesn't find any. He sends to Israel prophet after prophet after prophet to urge them to repentance and to call them to their covenant relationship. And what does Israel do to these prophets? They kill them and stone them and malign them. And you start to think, what's going on here, Lord? What's going on? Why would you keep sending prophets, Lord? Isn't that a waste of prophets? And then you understand, this isn't a crazy owner that's being described here, someone who's out of his mind. This is describing a merciful and compassionate God who gives chance after chance after chance. He's so full of love and pity and mercy. He's so willing to receive and forgive that he's not going to spare any kind of expense. When it comes to this owner, you think you're really crazy, man. At this point, by verse 13, you've seen what they've done to the servants. You're crazy if you're going to send your son into that situation. But friends, notice the heart of God, that he would send his only son, his beloved son, into a hostile and wicked world. What a God this is. What do they do with the son? So now we're shifting into Israel's present. What is Israel doing with the son of the owner of the vineyard? Right now, in the present, in real time, they're doing this, and they're about to do this. They said, verse 14, "This is the heir. Let's kill him so that the inheritance may be ours." And they threw him out of the vineyard and killed him. They'll stone you when you're God's beloved son. That shows you the depth of the wickedness of not just the people of Israel, but the leadership of Israel, these tenants, that they would kill the beloved son of God who has come. It shows you, and I hope I'm really hoping that you don't think, oh, that's just those guys. That's just Israel. That's just Pharisees and scribes that have that wicked heart. Friends, we have these wicked hearts too. And while we were still sinners, while we were still enemies, God sent his son to die for us. The amazing thing is that the beloved son is willing to be despised and rejected and abused and eventually killed in order to have a people for his praise. Well, I gotta hurry on to the next point, which is they'll stone you and then you'll be all done. Because I'm looking at this verse here lands, this rhetorical question lands pretty heavy at the end of verse 15. After the owner sent servant after servant after servant, and then his beloved son, and they kill him. Here's the question that comes. What then will the owner of the vineyard do to them? And it's almost like it trails off. Like you can't even, you can just imagine what that owner is going to do. He's going to be indignant. He's going to be full of anger and wrath and hot judgment. It is right for him to be that way. It's right for him to have that righteous indignation about the way that his prophets and his Christ have been treated. And this word comes to us. It certainly comes in the first case to the scribes and the Pharisees, but it also comes to us. Like, what do you think is going to be your end on that great day when you stand face to face with God, your creator and your judge? God, having sent his beloved son into this world to die as a substitute for sinners like you, and you have rejected him. You've pushed him away. You've killed him for all intents and purposes with your dismissal and rejection of him. What do you think is left for you after that? And I can tell you that the only thing that is left for those who reject Christ, finally, at the end of the day, is eternal wrath and judgment in a place called hell. How will we escape if we don't cling on to the Christ that God has sent? There's nothing that's coming. There's nothing coming behind the air as another chance. It's Christ or nothing. And if you reject Christ, you reject your only hope in this life and in the life to come. They'll stone you and you'll be all done. And just think about the wrath. It's not just standard wrath. When you think about wrath, the kind of mercy that this landowner has shown, the kind of patience and compassion and mercy, to reject the son at the end of all of that mercy, I think that just heightens the wrath. You're just storing up wrath for yourself on the day of visitation. You think about earlier in Luke where Jesus argued to certain cities, certain groups of people that had lots more access to Christ and lots more access to his teaching, and that they could see his mighty acts. And what does Jesus say? He says, woe to you in this city, because if Sodom and Gomorrah got to hear these kinds of things that I'm saying and see these kinds of things, they would have repented long ago. And it's going to go way better for the residents of Sodom and Gomorrah on Judgment Day than it's going to go for you. And I tremble to think about the judgment that might be poured out on a person that has gone to a Bible-believing, Bible-preaching church all of their life, and yet have still rejected Christ. Where from the time that they were babies, had nursery workers and Sunday school workers and kids club teachers and youth leaders and pastors who were faithful to preach the truth of the gospel, and then to reject that, I shudder to think of what the owner of the vineyard might do to you. He will come and destroy those tenants and give the vineyard to others. When they heard this, they said, "Surely not." This is a very strong response. They're like, "No way, this can't happen." And this brings up our conclusion. And that is, I would not feel so all alone. Everybody must get stoned. What I mean by that is that you are going to have to decide, you're going to have to come to a conclusion about your relationship with the stone. At this point, Jesus quotes from Psalm 118. It's the passage that Glenn read at the beginning of the service. It's the passage that Jesus entered into the city triumphantly to, these shouts from the people. But that passage goes on to say, and you may have recognized it from the reading this morning, the stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. And really, this is an image of masonry, of stone masonry. When you're building a house, you got to have, it's very important that you have in the corner a perfectly square stone, because that's going to set the course this direction and that direction and this direction. And if it's off a little bit, then over the course of a building, everything's going to be out of whack. And so in those in that time, builders, masons would look through all of the rocks that they had available, and they'd pick one up and look at it, and if it wasn't right, they'd chuck it and keep looking for the right stone for the corner or for the cap. And this passage is saying to a rebellious people that what they've done is they've actually taken, they've picked up the best rock, the one rock that's going to be the cornerstone, and they've looked it over and said, nah, and chucked it. And that rock was Jesus Christ. They've rejected him. And so they're going to continue to build their little building, right? And it's going to be a disaster. And not only that, but they've chucked out this rock, and now they're going to stumble over this rock. They're ultimately going to be crushed on this rock when it falls on them. Because what God has done is he's taken that rock, who is Christ, and he's made him the cornerstone in this great new building, this great new people of God. And all of those who are united to Christ by faith are part of that building. They're hanging together on that rock. And so my point is to simply say to every one of us here today that we have to make a, you got to come to a conclusion about where you stand in terms of the cornerstone. Is Jesus Christ the rock that you've tripped over? You stumble over his words and his teaching and everything he's about. Are you chucking him to the side, rejecting him, thinking that you're going to build your life on some other kind of matter? That's one option. The other option is to say, without Christ, I am nothing. And I need him as the foundation of this life that I'm building. It's when you make Jesus Christ your cornerstone that you can be part of this living, vital building and union. You have to have some relationship with the stone. Either he's going to be your cornerstone, or you're going to have that stone fall on you and crush you in the judgment. Friends, this is just a simple challenge to us today. Where do you stand with Christ? Is Christ your all? Is Christ your life? Or have you rejected him? And the Bible is very clear about the implications, the consequences of each of those things. And so my prayer is that all of us would be found in this building where Christ is the cornerstone, indeed the capstone.